So good morning, everyone. We will get started. I just want to welcome everybody to our latest State of the Economy call. I don't know how it happens, but it seems like every year, particularly in the spring calls, something unexpected always happens that throws a little bit of uncertainty over our outlook for the year. Certainly makes it a challenge for us to put together materials to talk about what's happening. But the positive side of that is it gives us a chance to get in front of you and let you know what we're thinking and how we're dealing with the uncertainty that we're seeing today. And hopefully when we go through these call and the slides, it'll give you a little bit of peace of mind about what's going on in the world today. So with that, I'm going to share my screen and we'll go through some slides. Okay, so hopefully you should be on the State of the Economy slide here. We're going to get started. I think, as I alluded to, there have been significant events that have occurred this year so far, namely the conflict in Iran. And when we go through things like this, you know, the key for us is to focus on what we know and think about how what is happening might or will affect our longer-term outlook. There's a lot of different things we're looking at today more closely than we might have been at the beginning of the year. And we're certainly following supply chain disruptions. We're looking at the pace or lack of activity coming through the Strait of Hormuz. We're following very closely energy prices and thinking about how those might impact global economic growth, the U.S. consumer, etc. We're looking at inflation expectations, and we're closely monitoring tax refund activity as that can provide some ballast for consumers in these more difficult times. So today, what we're going to focus on a little bit more is what we know, and we'll weave into that what we're thinking about how the conflict in Iran could impact that. So we'll talk about just the rising geopolitical risk and uncertainty and how that might impact the economy. We'll talk about our outlook for inflation and interest rates and the Fed. We'll talk about the longer term trend in inflation and lastly move into looking at volatility in the market and what our expectations are for the market for the rest of the year. So a pretty packed agenda and we'll get started. I think what we're dealing with right now is the things that we expected coming into the year, which were solid economic growth, probably an acceleration from last year. The pillars that supported that outlook were a healthy consumer, a solid labor market, the positive impacts for both business and consumer from the One Big Beautiful Bill Act that passed last year. Those things are still intact. And the question that we're dealing with today is, does the conflict in Iran change those? Does it change it in the short run? Does it change it for the long term? And we really don't know the answer to that today. Will higher energy prices slow consumer spending? Will it slow business investment? It's largely going to depend on how long the conflict lasts and how quickly we can return to traffic through the Strait of Hormuz and get the oil and energy markets back into a balance between supply and demand. So obviously, the sooner you get a resolution, the better it would be for global growth. And if it's resolved sooner, we could see growth closer to what we expected at the beginning of the year, being an acceleration from last year. If it takes longer, we might see growth being closer to trend or maybe slightly below trend. The level of uncertainty has certainly increased inflation risks, and that's something we're monitoring very closely. But our base case is still positive economic growth. In the last few days, we've seen a little bit of a shift in the strategy in Iran to focus more on economic versus military activities. The blockade of the Strait of Hormuz is intended to cause more economic damage in Iran in the hopes that it will bring them to the table. But we don't know what's going to happen, and it really is changing from day to day. So what, again, we're going to focus on what we think is going to happen and what we can control. So with that, I'm going to move on to page 4, a slide that I know you're all familiar with. This is U.S. GDP growth The green bars are the quarterly GDP growth looking backwards. The gray bars are expectations going forward. Looking backward a little bit, I would note 2025 was a year of solid economic growth. We saw a lot of volatility quarter over quarter, and most of that was driven by trade activity. We had net exports in particular, people increasing inventories ahead of expected tariffs, and then that working its way through the system over time. But overall, we had pretty stable growth for the year. You probably note that Q4 of 2025 looks relatively weak with economic growth at just 0.5%. That was due in large part to the government shutdown at the beginning of the quarter. That subtracted about 1 percentage point from fourth quarter GDP. If you look outside of that, consumer spending was up year over year and contributed about 1.3 percentage points to GDP. And then business investment was also a positive, adding about 0.5% to GDP. So, you know, I think if we look at the backward looking data, it doesn't tell us a whole lot about what's happening going forward. But first quarter, we still see consumer spending being the main driver of GDP growth. We have had some signs of weakness throughout the quarter. We had weather-related effects, particularly on the East Coast earlier in the year that impacted spending a little bit. But in general, we're looking at about a 1.5% annualized GDP growth in the first quarter, mostly driven by consumer, but we're still seeing good business investment. Last year, a lot of the business spending was AI infrastructure related. Going forward, we still expect to see AI being the main driver of business investment, but we do believe that we'll see more broad-based growth across a lot of sectors, and that's driven in large part by the benefits for corporate investment that were built into the tax changes last year. If you look out over the rest of the year, what we're showing here is above-trend growth. We haven't changed these forecasts based on what has happened most recently, but they could change a little bit depending on how long the impact to the energy markets continues. But in general, I would say we're looking at moderate economic growth this year. Yes, recession risk is higher because of the uncertainty, but we still believe that we can see positive GDP growth for the year. One of the keys to that, and one of the things that we've talked a lot about, is the labor market. Because the consumer is such an important part of our economy, the labor market is really critical to continued positive economic growth. The labor market, we would describe it as okay, steady. We're not gaining a lot of new jobs, but we're not losing jobs. So it's not gangbusters, it's not robust, but it's good enough for the environment that we're in. The left-hand side of the page is the non-farm payroll report, which gives us growth in new jobs on a month-over-month basis. And you can see it's been pretty volatile over the last year on a month-over-month basis. We've seen some months where jobs were lost, jobs coming back in the next month. In general, we've added over the last 12 months about 260,000 new jobs, which is pretty low, but it's enough to keep the unemployment rate steady. You might notice February had a pretty large decline in jobs, and that was mostly due to a strike in the healthcare sector in California at Kaiser Permanente that reversed itself this quarter. But in general, we're showing a little bit of job growth, not a lot. On the right-hand side of the page is the new applications for unemployment insurance. And this is a great measure because it's timely, it's weekly data, and it's based on actual applications for unemployment. And it is a smooth four-week average. This is telling us that we're not seeing an increase in people applying for unemployment insurance. So the left-hand side is telling us we're not really gaining a lot of jobs. The right-hand side is telling us that we're not really losing a lot of jobs currently. If we can remove some of the uncertainty and some of the things that we were expecting at the beginning of the year in terms of benefits from business investment, we could see a pickup in the labor market. But for right now, steady is okay. It supports wages, it supports consumer health, and provides a backdrop for consumer spending. Digging a little deeper into the labor market on page 6, on the left-hand side, you have the unemployment rate. And as I just mentioned, It's relatively steady. It's about 4.3% currently. It's up from the lows that we've seen more recently, but on a historic basis, it's still relatively low. I think what's important as we look at this is on the right-hand side of the page. The dark line is the labor force participation rate. So this is the number of people that are of working age that are either employed currently or actively seeking employment. So you can see that that line has been declining really over several years. It's a number of factors, sort of a structural change that we've seen here. The aging of the baby boomer population, we're seeing more retirements coming out of the labor market, and we're not replacing them with younger workers. And then more recently, we've also seen a little bit of an impact from less immigration. So the labor force participation rate overall has been shrinking a little bit, and that has allowed the unemployment rate to stay relatively steady, even though we're not adding a lot of jobs. It means that we don't need to add as many jobs in order to keep the unemployment rate steady. The important part of this is the light green line, the lime green. That's the what we call the prime age. So these are people in the labor force, so again, either employed or actively looking, that are between the ages of 25 and 54. That's the core of our labor market. It's the largest in terms of numbers. It's the largest in terms of contribution to spending and to all the great economic activity that we're looking for. And you can see here, we're not seeing a change in the participation rate there. It's been relatively steady. And that's good news for the labor market going forward. Before we leave the labor market, I don't have a chart for this, but I thought it would be helpful to make a couple of comments on productivity growth and its impact on the labor market. We've seen productivity increase pretty dramatically for most of last year. In fact, the last three quarters of last year, U.S. worker productivity increased 4.1% on an annualized basis. And that's important because when workers are more productive, it means that the cost of labor is less for business. That allows them to invest more in other investments. So the investment that we have seen in technology and particularly AI has been driving some of these productivity gains. But again, the importance is that higher productivity means that companies can expand their business without necessarily adding to the labor force or adding new employees, but they can also expand and add new employees without significantly increasing their unit costs. So this has been particularly helpful for small businesses, which for the better part of the last 3 years have been telling us that they're struggling to find quality workers. Now they can use technology investment and AI investment to not have to add that extra worker that they're struggling to find. The bigger picture and the broader benefit for the economy is that productivity allows for growth in the labor force. It allows for growth in the economy. It tends to, over time, lead to increasing living standards. And all of those things happen without any impact to inflation. And as a side part of this, we've had a lot of questions about, will AI replace workers? And is this going to be a bad thing for the labor market over the long term? And what we'd say is historically, innovations, whether it be AI, the internet, or you know, you can go back to the Industrial Revolution, innovations tend to not have a significant impact on the current labor market. They certainly change the types of skills that people need to compete in the labor market. But over time, as you lower the cost for a new innovation and expand the number of uses and the access to that innovation, it actually leads to more jobs and better economic activity. So we're very early in the stages of this technology evolution, and we don't know where it will end up, but we don't have concerns about a major disruption to the labor market. And we think that over the long term, this increase in productivity benefits earnings growth, it benefits employees, and it benefits the economy as a whole. So moving on to the consumer. Briefly, we've always looked at consumer confidence, which is on the left-hand side of the page. It's tended to historically have a very strong correlation to consumer activity. It makes sense. If if we feel good about the outlook for the economy and for the future, we're more willing to spend today. If we feel worse about the outlook going forward, we might start to save and not spend as much. What we've seen is that consumer confidence has been weak for a number of years. We start to see a little bit of improvement and then it tends to trail off. So the consumer is not expressing that they feel good. However, the activity, this consumer spending, is actually still relatively strong. And you can see that on the right-hand side of the page. This is the real personal consumption expenditures index. So it's the overall level of consumer spending in our economy. The green line is the growth or the dollar amount of spending, and the dotted line is the longer term trend. So even though people are telling us they may not feel as good about the future, they're still spending. So, you know, it's an interesting dichotomy, and I think, you know, you could do a whole discussion just on the internals of the Consumer Confidence Index, and we're seeing significant gaps in how people feel depending on their age group, depending on geography, depending on political affiliation, that are a lot different than what we've seen in the past. So it's an interesting thing. Hopefully it will begin to be more of a tell on future spending. But the important thing you should take away from this chart is that the consumer is doing okay, they're spending. We don't expect to see a significant decline in consumer spending going forward. So here's our first page that gets at what's happening more currently today. And obviously, when I talk about the impacts of the conflict in Iran, I'm talking about it from an economic standpoint and certainly not a human standpoint. But the most immediate impact that we're seeing is the increase in energy prices. On the left-hand side of the page, you have the price per barrel of oil going back to 2004. You can see that since the start of the conflict, oil has almost doubled. We reached a high of about 114 per barrel last week, and we've since come down. That's not shown on this chart. This morning, it was around $92 a barrel, but it's certainly elevated relative to where we've been more recently and relative to the trend that we've had more recently, which is to lower prices. This is completely driven by a supply shock. You know, 20% of global oil shipments come through the Strait of Hormuz. In addition to the strait being closed and that supply not coming out, we have had some infrastructure in the Middle East that's been impacted, and it may take some time to repair that infrastructure and get it back online. So even if we do see the strait reopen soon, it'll probably take a little longer before we get supply back to the levels that we saw prior to the war starting. For the U.S., it's less of a supply issue. We receive about 2% of our oil coming through the Strait of Hormuz. Really, for us, prices in the energy market are global, so we're being impacted by the higher prices, but our supply of oil is still strong, and that's not creating any issues for our economy, but it certainly is for the global economy. If you look at China, India, Japan, South Korea, they account for about 70% of the flows that come through the Strait of Hormuz. China and Japan have tended to hold really high oil reserves over time, and that's helped them in the near term. But the longer the strait remains closed, the more they'll have an impact, not just from that price, but from a supply standpoint. And we're also seeing across Europe that they're dealing not only with supply issues, but price issues as well. So it's a global disruption. For the U.S., it's a price disruption, but not a supply disruption directly. But that price impact is significant. You can see that on the right-hand side of the page. This is the average annual cost of driving your car, and it's based on an assumption that you drive 12,000 miles a year and your car gets 25 miles per gallon in efficiency. So the long-term average is about $1,400 a year to drive that 12,000 miles. We've seen that go up just since the start of the year. The annual cost of driving your car is up about $625. and it's just below $2,000 a year. So that's a significant real impact to consumers. In the short run, consumers can offset that with savings, with higher tax refunds, which I haven't talked about, but have been significantly important. Tax refunds are up about 10% year over year. So that is a benefit for the consumer, but it doesn't last forever. But consumers have the ability to work through the near term. The question is, if this continues and high prices persist, at what point is consumer behavior impacted? And we don't have an answer to that yet, but that's something we're very closely paying attention to. So that leads into our outlook for inflation. Obviously, in the near term, we expect that inflation is going to increase. We have a price increase in the energy sector, and that's going to feed through into inflation measures. Here, we've got the core personal consumption expenditures index. We use that because it's the Fed's preferred measure. Now, you'll note it's a core read, so it doesn't include food and energy, so it wouldn't pick up the increase in oil prices most recently. This is really about trends in longer-term inflation. But even the headline inflation numbers haven't fully reflected the increase in energy prices just because of the timing of the data. But the important thing is we have seen a little bit of an increase in core prices lately. It's mainly come through from services prices, things like insurance and healthcare costs. But we don't expect that to continue significantly if we get a resolution on the energy price and a resolution in Iran. Core prices will pick up at higher energy costs over time, even though they're not directly tied to energy prices. But what we're seeing is there have been trends to lower inflation that still exist today, even with the higher energy prices that are expected in the short run. And so one of the reasons we think that inflation, even though it might go up in the short run, should continue to trend lower over the back half of the year. The first one is the impact of tariffs. Tariffs are a one-time price adjustment. A lot of that occurred in the second and third quarter of last year. As we begin to move past those price increases, that will have the effect of lowering inflation on a year-over-year basis. And also, the tariff rates have been coming down as we made more trade deals with countries. And in fact, even before the Supreme Court decision on the IEEPA tariffs, the effective rate had come down to about 10%. So we're going to lap the initial price increase, and we're seeing that tariffs are lower than what we expected early on. So that's a positive for the outlook for inflation. And the second thing is what you see on the right-hand side of the page, and that's the shelter component of the consumer price index. So the green line is the shelter component of consumer price index, and the gray line is the Zillow rent index, which reflects current pricing in the rental market. So it gives us a current look at what's happening, whereas CPI is actual changes in rental prices. When prices are going up or going down, it takes a lot longer for those to work through and to be reflected in consumer price index because rents are on a contract and contracts don't reprice every day. So they tend to come into the inflation equation with a lag and they tend to leave with a lag. But what I would take from this chart is if you look at that gray line, rental price increases have been dropping from the peak that we saw a few years ago, and we're at a point where currently across the country, average rents are rising about 1% on a year-over-year basis. And we expect that shelter piece of the CPI index will continue to reflect closer to what that Zillow's information is telling us about current inflation. And the reason that's also important is the shelter component is about a third of the CPI index. So all else being equal, the rolling off of tariffs and getting the current inflation on rental property or rents into the CPI index will push inflation lower. And that's assuming that we get a resolution and get energy prices coming back to a more normal level. So our long-term outlook is still that inflation can be lower going forward. I don't know that we'll get to the Fed's 2% target, but we can certainly see it come down to that 2 to 3% range that we've talked about for some time. And really, when we talk about inflation, I'm on page 10 now, the key in the short run is inflation expectations. That's what really impacts consumer behavior. If consumers are concerned about inflation, they might stop spending, they might wait to see where prices go, they might put off large ticket items if they think prices are too high now but are coming back later. So we very closely monitor inflation expectations. And here you've got 2-year and 10-year inflation expectations. And these are based on pricing in the Treasury Inflation Protected Securities Market, or the TIPS market. So what the lime green line is telling you, what investors believe inflation will average over the next 2 years. And the dark green line is expectations for inflation over the next 10 years on average. So we've seen most recently short-term expectations rose pretty significantly along with energy prices. They reached about 3.5% in mid-March. They've since come back down a little bit. But the important thing is the longer-term expectations. That 10-year inflation rate has remained relatively steady around 2.3%. So the market is telling us that, yes, we expect prices to be higher over the near term, but we believe that over time they will come back down, and over the longer term we'll have much more stable inflation, a little bit closer to that 2.3% rate. As an aside, if you looked at one-year inflation expectations, they went up much more dramatically. They hit about 5.5% in mid-March. They're down today to about 3.5%. So again, it's a short term, and we'd like to see those long-term inflation expectations anchored. That's best for consumer activity. I'm going to talk just briefly about interest rates, and certainly the conflict in Iran has had an impact on the interest rate markets, particularly shorter maturity bonds. So on the left-hand side of the page is the yield of the 2-year Treasury note. And you can see that rose about 50 basis points over the last several weeks. And that's really a reflection of uncertainty about how higher prices in the short run and expected inflation might impact the Fed's ability to continue lowering rates. So the market has kind of removed any expectation of Fed rate cuts in the near term. The yield on the 10-year Treasury moved a little bit higher, but not nearly as much as we see on the 2-year. And that really reflects, again, kind of the longer-term outlook that inflation should be more stable once we get through this period. And so it's, you know, kind of a two sides of a story there. Another note, mortgage rates tend to be correlated with the 10-year Treasury. So this move up in Treasury rates on the 10-year has also pushed mortgage rates up higher, and that's really been pushing off any potential recovery in the housing market, at least over the near term. Moving into the Fed, here you've got the dark green line is the Fed funds rate. The gray line is the 2-year Treasury yield, which we just talked about. And you can see when you put these two together, I just mentioned it, but the 2-year Treasury is very correlated with expected changes in the Fed funds rate. And so when the Fed has been cutting rates, we've seen the 2-year go down to about 3.5%, which was sort of where the Fed was expected maybe to stop cutting rates. It's since gone back up again. As I said, people are not so sure that the Fed can cut rates in the current environment. The lime green line that extends from the Fed funds rate is what the Federal Reserve has told us they think their forecast for rates is. And you can see it's not much. They're pricing in one rate cut at the end of this year and one in 2027. So pretty moderate expectations. Market expectations are for no rate cuts this year or next year. And I think I mentioned in the header here, the dual mandate should keep the Fed on hold. One of the things that, the Fed has this dual mandate of maintaining price stability and maintaining full employment. And so because of that, they're less likely to act based on near-term inflation pressures, because to do so, to raise rates into current inflation concerns, could impact longer-term growth and the labor market. People have talked about whether the Fed should or would raise rates. We don't believe that they will. Fed Chair Powell has told us that they are going to look through the higher energy costs today and continue to monitor the data going forward, but they don't have any intention of reacting to the short term. And we believe if they did, it would be a mistake. You know, global central banks, most of them have a single mandate rather than that dual mandate, and their single mandate is to maintain price stability. It makes it a little bit harder for them in these environments, and there's certainly some risk that central banks may raise rates in order to offset the impact of near-term higher prices. But for the U.S. Fed, we believe they'll be on hold for a while, and we take Chair Powell at his word. We will have a new chair potentially coming in May, but we don't think that's going to change the outlook for interest rates anytime soon. I'm going to move into talking a little bit about the equity markets. The data that you see here on page 13 is returns through April 10th, so last Friday. You can see through that time period on a year-to-date basis on the left, the S&P was basically flat. It had been down as much as 9% throughout the course of the first quarter, but we have seen a rally a little bit of late. I think what's important to see is we're seeing different sectors participate. A significant portion of the market did better than the S&P as a whole. So we had a lot of sectors and companies that actually had positive contributions during the first quarter and into the second quarter. Energy was the best performing sector, as was materials. That's mainly driven by higher commodity prices. But we've also seen, you know, industrials doing quite well. Utility and consumer staples, which are more defensive, also benefited from the uncertainty of the environment. On the downside, technology, healthcare, discretionary, and finance were the underperformers so far year to date. On the right-hand side of the page, you have the trailing 12 months through April 10th. And again, I think the returns are very high when you include the earlier parts of last year. The S&P over the trailing 12 months is up 31%. Energy remains the top performing sector, and technology and some of the others that we've talked a lot about are also on that higher end. I think the message here is that we are seeing more companies participating and more sectors participating. Prior to the second half of last year, the previous year and a half or 2 years, returns in the market were driven by that narrow set of technology and communications companies that were driving the returns. This is a much healthier market where we're seeing contributions from a broader range of companies and where diversification across sectors really matters. And we expect that's going to continue going forward. Now, I would say, given the high returns that we've seen in the last couple of years, we don't expect to see market returns in those high double digits like we have experienced. But we do think that we can see positive returns in the market this year, just maybe more muted. Corporate earnings are expected to grow double digits this year, and that will really support the market. But it could be the case that market prices don't rise as fast as earnings, whereas in the past couple of years, prices have risen faster than earnings. So we may see a rebalance there. But overall, the health of the S&P 500 and the underlying 500 companies looks pretty strong as we move through the year. That's not to say we won't have a lot of volatility. We've talked a lot about the situation in Iran and the uncertainty that that's creating and the volatility we're seeing there. In addition, it's not unusual to have more volatility in a midterm election year. So here on page 14, you can see the average returns of the S&P 500 on the left-hand side, broken down by the year we are in each administration. So year one is strong. Year two tends to have positive but lower returns. Year three, you see a recovery in the market, and then year four is positive but more moderate returns. So we're in a year that's historically a little bit weaker for market returns. That's because of the uncertainty that midterm election cycles can bring. We've seen a lot more election volatility over the past several cycles. And in fact, we've seen a change in leadership in Congress in every midterm election, I think over the last five cycles or so. So when election and political volatility is high, market volatility and uncertainty will be high. You can also see that on the right-hand side of the page, this shows the average drawdown, so market decline intra-year, broken out by those same first, second, third, and fourth year of an administration. And you see that on average, the market has a drawdown of about 13% on an annual basis. In midterm election years, that drawdown tends to be closer to 19%. Doesn't mean that's what'll happen, but it's just telling you historically that we do tend to see more uncertainty in the market in those years. The good news is that once the election passes and the uncertainty dissipates, the market tends to react very strongly in the 12 months preceding that election. So the message here is expect volatility, but it doesn't mean that we're in a bad market environment. And the last market chart that I'll show you, you've seen before, and really tells the same story, but doesn't break it out by political or administration years or election years. And this is just the green bars are the annual return of the S&P 500, and the green diamonds are the intra-year drawdown in each one of those years. So again, it's not unusual to see an intra-year decline in the market, but it doesn't mean that you're going to have a negative return when the market sees a large drawdown. So far this year, a little hard to read, but we had the market was down as much as 9% earlier in the first quarter. And again, this is as of April 10th, the market was back up to being flat. And as of last night, the S&P 500 is up about 2%. So this is just to put all of that volatility in perspective and hopefully make you feel better about the potential going forward. We have a few minutes and I'm real quickly going to move into a totally different topic. We get a lot of questions about the dollar. Is the dollar going to collapse? Is it going to continue to be the reserve currency? And I think I want to address it just real quickly in a couple of ways. You know, I think the recent move in the dollar looks dramatic when you look at it in isolation, but if you look at it relative to the longer history of the dollar, it's not so dramatic. On the right-hand side of the page, I'll start there. That's just the value of the dollar from the start of last year, so 2025 through last week. And you can see there was a significant decline in the dollar, in fact, from the peak that we saw at the beginning of 2025 until the trough that we saw, it was down about 12%. That was mainly due to the impact of the expected tariffs and then the tariffs that were announced on Liberation Day being much greater than expected. So we saw that decline in the dollar. Once we moved past that, we kind of entered a range where the dollar was relatively steady. It was up and, you know, it's moving around a lot, but in a pretty narrow range. So yes, we've had weakening in the dollar over the last year. But if you look on the left-hand side of the page and compare where the dollar is today relative to history, it's still at a reasonable level. And what you see on the left-hand side of the page is the dollar goes through many, many cycles. Those are driven by any number of factors. It can be geopolitical risk. It can be differentials in growth between the U.S. and the rest of the world, trade flows. There's a lot of things that can impact that. But I think what we see in this is that we're not in a position of believing that the dollar is going to stop being the reserve currency or that we'll see a significant collapse. And a couple of quick data points that support that. You often hear about how foreign investors don't want to hold U.S. assets. The data really doesn't show that. If you look at foreign holdings of U.S. treasuries, they're relatively steady over time. Now, which countries hold more or less, that changes, and that changes in large part due to trade flows. So we've seen over the last several years a shifting of supply chains and different countries now transacting with the U.S. that didn't before. So to the extent that, say, a China holds less treasuries today than they did 5 years ago, South Korea holds more. So that change is occurring. 80% of all global trade has the dollar on at least one side. So it's still the transactor of choice. As a net importer country, that's going to keep the dollar as part of that global trade. And I'd say in general, the global currency reserves, it is the case that they have been diversifying away from the dollar. That really began in 2000, so we're about 25, 26 years into that diversification. A lot of that has moved towards the euro as the euro became more stable and more of a global currency to be used. But in 2000, around 70% of global currency reserves were denominated in dollars. And today that's about 65%. So over 25 years, we've seen about a 5% decline in global currency reserves in US dollars. So again, all of the things that people talk about, they are happening on the margins, but it's not something that we think rises to a collapse in the dollar or concerns about the dollar going forward. So with that, I've run slightly over. Just to conclude, I'd just like to point out uncertainty is high right now, and just reiterate to you, we don't react to the events of the day and the changes which happen nearly every day lately. What we want to do is focus on the things that we know and stick to our fundamental processes, which have helped us through all number of global events over the years. So we continue to focus on, from a bottom up, the companies we own, making sure that they have a business model and flexibility to get through near-term uncertainty and near-term disruptions, but still generate long-term value. We believe in diversification in our portfolios across sectors. And if you think back to the chart we just looked at, returns by sector, that diversification has really helped us throughout the first quarter. It's helped us over time. And that's one of the best ways you can protect yourself from the unknown. So we're going to continue to monitor everything that's going on. Our base case outlook for the U.S. economy and for the markets remains intact. If we start to believe that things are going to get worse or that the outlook is in jeopardy, we would make changes at that time. But for right now, we think that the outlook for our economy is solid. And with that, I'm going to wrap up. If you have any questions, please reach out to your wealth management advisor, and we will get you answers as quickly as we can. And thank you, everyone, for participating. And we look forward to the next call in the fall.